Thank you. I need to start off with Mr. Kaser and ask, what is the Interior Department's position with regard to reaching a settlement of the claims brought by the plaintiff? Is the department prepared to support a legislative solution?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Land-based accounts represent about 75% of all individual Indian money accounts and hold about half of the total balance of all such accounts. The other accounts are judgment accounts, per capita accounts, and special deposit accounts. Is that accurate?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it is.
Can you tell me what documentation the department has for the transactions, including leases, payments, and deposits in the land-based accounts?
Mr. Chairman, we have a substantial base of information regarding all types of accounts that we have. In the historical accounting effort that we've done thus far, we've accounted for around 50,000 of our judgment per capita accounts and in large part have all the information necessary to do those. Those relatively are simple to do. They involve a judgment or a settlement of some type that is paid to numerous accounts from a single core event. And then it's initial deposit in an account plus interest transactions. Those are relatively simple. In the case of land-based accounts, we have a substantial record of those as well. Depending on the time period involved, the availability of records varies somewhat. But the experience that we've had so far is generally we have somewhere between 85% and 99% of the records necessary to do the reconciliations that we're doing in our accounting project.
Is the accuracy of the accounting in the other accounts at all likely to be repeated in an accounting of the land-based accounts?
It's my understanding, Mr. Chairman, that we do have differences that involve both our judgment per capita accounts and land-based accounts. But as I said in my opening statement, they tend to be few, they tend to be small, and they tend to net near zero when you add both overpayments and underpayments together. So a conclusion is there are differences between what's in our ledger and what the supporting documents say, but there's not many of them. I've asked from our Office of Historical Trust Accounting to inquire with the firms that are actually conducting the accounting, and it's my understanding these represent four of the five largest accounting firms in the country that are involved, to ask the question whether there appears to be any evidence of systemic error in our accounting process and system, or whether there's been any evidence of fraud, or whether there's been any evidence of our electronic data being altered by hacking or other intrusions in our systems. And the answers to those questions so far has been no, that what we've identified in errors so far appear to be random errors associated with just human work, as opposed to any systemic problems with our system.
How do you respond to the argument that a statistical sampling analysis does not consider missing documents? Specifically, does a statistical sampling just confirm the existence of documents already in the possession of the Interior Department?
Well, the way we approach the statistical sampling process is in our land-based accounts, we've basically gone through a process of looking at the 1985 to 2000 tranche, which represents approximately $5.5 billion of throughput through these accounts. And in so doing, using the electronic information, we had a statistical accounting firm select a statistically based set of accounts, and then within those accounts select statistically selected transactions to do further evaluation of. In that particular tranche, we basically identified virtually all of the documents we needed to do the reconciliation that we were undertaking. It's my understanding, Mr. Chairman, that we basically had 99% plus of all the documents that we sought to do the reconciliation. And the document types that are involved is checks, incoming checks or copies of checks, the internal transaction documentation that we use to deposit checks and distribute the checks to where they belong. And as an example, what I mean by that is if I have a tract of land that is leased and it has 500 different owners on it due to fractionation, we have to have documentation of how we distributed one common check to the 500 recipients of the check. We also have documentation when we are making disbursements from accounts, and that is used as part of the reconciliation process for looking both at the incoming and the outgoing transactions in an account. In that particular tranche in land-based accounts, we had virtually all the documents that we needed. I think it's fair to say if you go further back in time, the further back you go, the more likelihood that you will have to find that there are missing documents. And it would be up to the statisticians in this case to make an interpretation of how significant the missing information is.
Thank you. I want to recognize Mr. Rahal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Deputy Secretary Kaysen, let me ask you, how do the error rates you've calculated in the judgment and the per capita counts compare to the error rates in other programs that are run by the federal government?
I'm sorry, Chairman, I'm sorry, Congressman Rahal. I'm not aware that we've actually gone through an exercise of trying to calculate error rates of program performance across the federal government to do that kind of comparison. When we've done the historical accounting process, the focus has been on the differences that we identify between ledger amounts and supporting documentation in our historical accounting effort. I imagine that it would be possible to cobble together some sort of comparison to other programs, but I'm not aware of that.
You know, could you do any of that cost comparison?
Yeah, I imagine that's possible.
If it's not too much time and effort involved, if you could have somebody do that and just submit it for the record?
Sure.
Okay. Is it reasonable to assume that modern accounting accuracy is a good proxy for what took place for the first 50 or 75 years for the trust?
Congressman Rahal, I can't really give you a good answer on that. What I can tell you is we're attempting not to speculate about what will happen in older time periods without actually having gone to look at them through the accounting process. Our experience so far in the historical accounting effort is very limited in the older time periods. So what information we have available right now would suggest that there's not a materially higher rate of error for the older time periods, but it's completely insufficient to draw an accurate fact-based conclusion on. We have more information about more current time period that represents about $5.5 billion of the throughput. And before we could really give you an accurate answer, we would actually have to go do some work in that area, and we haven't done that work yet. So we're trying not to speculate one way or the other as to what the error rate would be with older periods.
In your testimony, you state what remains to be determined is how much more accounting needs to be done before we can resolve these claims through administrative, judicial, or legislative means.
Yes.
My final question would be, how do we determine how much more accounting is needed?
Congressman Rahal, I don't think there's any one specific definition that would get there. And from our standpoint, as we're going through this, it will be a combination of effort between what's occurring in the judiciary system, what's occurring here on Capitol Hill, and the discussions we have within the administration. What's happening right now is if you look at where we were 4 or 5 years ago, we basically had no historical accounting effort or facts that had been completed at that time. And now we're $100 million into the process. We've done 50,000 judgment per capita counts and found very few errors. We've done a statistical sampling of the database for the last 15 years and found relatively few errors. We have a body of evidence associated with the Arthur Anderson accounting and tribal accounts from 1972 to 92. So if you go back another 15-year tranche, basically back to 1972, the error rate associated with the tribal accounts was very, very low. So we're having a growing body of evidence that suggests to us we don't have, at least so far, any appearance of a systemic problem with our accounting system or any evidence of systemic fraud involved with our employees who account for these monies. And that at some point in time, we will get to a point where Congress as an institution will say, okay, I have enough evidence to draw a conclusion, or the administration will come to Congress and say, we think we have enough evidence to draw a conclusion about where this is all headed. We're hopeful that the efforts to settle this will actually precede that level of accounting, that we can actually bring this thing to close, because we think it's more positive if we can actually reach a mutually acceptable solution to this process through legislation and bring the issue to a close. In the absence of that, then it looks like we have years more of accounting that we will need to do and years more of constant to-ing and fro-ing in court.
Thank you for your response.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate and understand and respect what you and Mr. Rahal are trying to do, because this, as I understand, has been in the courts for 9.5 years, and we want to bring this to some type of conclusion. I believe that you probably feel the same way that I do, because this does involve probably many billions of dollars, that we need to be very careful with this legislation. Right now, we don't really know how many, we don't have enough information on how many legitimate claimants there are, how much they would get per claimant, what is the total cost of the bill. The bill, as you said, is a work in progress, but it contains more blanks than any bill I've ever seen. The section 103 says blank billions on the initial deposit, also blank percentage on attorney's fees, blank percentage on the cost of administration. Section 104 has blank billions on the general distribution and share of the claimants. Section 108, blank per hour on attorney's fees. And that's what concerns me the most, I think, because I was a lawyer and a judge before I came to Congress. Sadly, we've sent so many millions of good jobs to other countries for so many years. We've got half the kids in the country either going to law school or thinking about it. We've got such a surplus of lawyers out there. We have really good lawyers who would come in and work on this for $100 an hour, and yet these Washington law firms charge just ungodly fees, and we've got to put some kind of limits on these attorney's fees. I know in the early 90s, in the savings and loan scandal, there was firms up here charging $650 and $850 an hour, and that was in the early 90s. Hate to think what some of them might charge now if we don't put some limits on it. In addition, in many of the major bankruptcies, the bankruptcy trustees and the bankruptcy lawyers have been awarded almost all of the money in some gigantic bankruptcies where the creditors got very little. This blank on the cost of administration concerns me, and I think we need to put some real strict limits on these things, or there's going to be some scandalous 60-minute 2020 Dateline-type shows out of this legislation. I don't have any questions, but I did want at least to put those remarks on the record. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Duncan. I know that Mr. Rahal and I agree with much of what you said in terms of the concerns about the overall cost, which is why when this bill was drafted, we did look at addressing those specific areas. I think when we get into filling in some of those blanks, hopefully you will be more comfortable, and I know I will be more comfortable with where we're going with the legislation, but that is a very legitimate point you bring up. Mr. Kildee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you again for your efforts in this very difficult question. I've been involved in legislative attempts to bring justice to our Native Americans for be 41 years next month. And I'd like to back up just a bit for maybe some of the newer members here. We've been at this 9 years, I think, in this committee here. Generally speaking, what led to where we are today? Is it a combination of nonfeasance, misfeasance, and malfeasance, just to give a historical background to the cause for this?
Well, Congressman Kildee, I would take a different position. There is certainly lots of public rhetoric about the lack of feasances, all three of those, within the Department of Interior and the implementation of this program. I think there's a different causal factor that's associated with this than that. And it's my sense that if you take a look at the statutory history of this trust, there has never been any instruction from Congress regarding what sort of accountings needed to be done at any point prior to 1994. So when you take a look at the operation of this trust over time, there hasn't been any instruction from Congress that said, do this kind of an accounting provided in this time period, have this kind of information involved. That first happened in 1994. Where we are with this litigation is that the plaintiffs have made a point with the court, and the court agreed that there is some inherent obligation to do accounting that the department had not complied with, and that we've been in 9 years' worth of effort to try and define what exactly that accounting requirement is. And even after 9 years of litigation, it is still not clear exactly what is required of the department to do an accounting. What we have at this point is the department's plan, which we submitted to Congress and to the court, and Congress thus far has not decided to even fund that plan. We also had the district court's plan that has been vacated now by the Court of Appeals twice. That was a much more expensive, much more exacting plan that Congress equally was unwilling to fund. So I would say the root of it is not so much malfeasance, misfeasance of the case. It's rather there hasn't been any clear direction over the last 100 years as to what the expectations are. And that's one of the fundamental flaws or problems associated with managing this trust.
I thank you for your response, and I think too also we have to recognize here in the Congress that the trust responsibility towards the Native Americans is with the entire federal government.
That's
not
correct.
Just the Department of Interior, it's the Congress also, and that therefore we cannot dodge our maybe our nonfeasance if that be that. The trust responsibility certainly is not just in the Department of Interior or the BIA. It's also here with the Congress, and we're trying to ferret out all the facts and trying to get justice in this. Let me ask you this question. Judge Lamberth feels that the comprehensive accounting would cost about $12 billion, and I think the department figures that can be done for about $335 million. How do you account for the wide disparity between Lamberth's cost for the accounting and what you feel the cost of the accounting will be?
That's a great question. The principal differences that lead to the dollar figure differences. First is the class for whom you would do an accounting. In our case, we basically defined the class of who we would do an accounting for as those individuals who had an account open on or after the date of the 1994 Act. So we'd be doing around 275 to 300,000 accounts. The Judge Lamberth plan basically is an accounting for all accounts that have ever been since 1887. So there's a much wider panoply of accounts that need to be done. The second major driver is the approach used to do the accounting. The big driver for money is in the land-based accounts, and it's particularly a problem due to fractionation of Indian individual allotments. And in that particular case for land-based accounts, what we had proffered to do was to use a statistical sampling process for reconciling transactions with the underlying supporting data. So we wouldn't attempt to do every transaction. We'd do a statistical sample of them to do that reconciliation. In Judge Lambert's plan, we were required to do the statistical we were required to do the reconciliation on every single transaction. So it balloons materially when you have to do every transaction, because there are literally tens of millions of transactions that have occurred over that time, many of which are very, very small transactions where the cost of doing the reconciliation way exceeds the value of the transaction. So those are two principal drivers. There was also a requirement to do an accounting for all land-based transactions that occurred since 1887. That materially added to the cost as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kaysen.
You're
welcome.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hayworth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kaysen, thank you. My colleagues, I was listening to my good friend from Michigan. I thought back to the Trust Fund Task Force that he and I co-chaired nearly a decade ago. And listening to both his comments and those of our friend from Tennessee, this challenge of trying to get our arms around this is considerable, to say the least. And I commend the chairman and the ranking member, as well as Senator McCain and the other body, for trying to make order. You know, we really can't call it order out of chaos. It's, to a large degree, order out of the unknown. Mr. Kaysen, you pointed out, again, historically, the difference in the assessments of Judge Lambert going back to the 19th century. A point more recently, as you take a look, there's a lot to get our arms around. Let me take something that is of great importance to a tribe in the 5th Congressional District of Arizona. I represent the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community as part of what is known as the Section 122 Tribes, the Tribal Trust Reform Demonstration Project. One of the concerns the tribe has mentioned to me is obtaining some of the funding it's entitled to under this demonstration project. Could you give me an update as to where the department is with regard to funding the Section 122 tribes?
Sure. Congressman, I personally meet periodically with the 122 tribes. I think it used to be 139 tribes and 131 tribes before that, because it's been going through a succession of appropriations bills and being placed in different sections. But we go through a periodic meeting schedule with the tribes to talk about what's involved in their demonstration project, what sorts of accommodations they want from the Department of Interior. The principal core funding that comes to these tribes is in the form of compacts or contracts that they get through our Indian self-determination process. And each of these tribes are given those funds that they're entitled to under self-determination and have been for the last several years and would be under 2006. We also had requirements through those sections to do audits of each of those groups to make sure that they were implementing their programs properly. OST, Ross could comment on, has done that. And in large part, we found that they were doing a job that was equally as proficient as what we were doing. So I think that the process is ongoing and that they are getting the funding to which they're entitled. And we're looking to ensure that there's a good, solid relationship to facilitate and enable their ability to make more decisions for themselves.
So, again, just to make sure I understand, this is being funded through the compacts and contracts commensurate with self-determination.
Right.
By and large, the audits are showing proficiency equal with what is transpiring. One other question is we're always dealing with money up here, isn't it?
It's a problem.
To say the least, how much funding do you anticipate distributing to these tribes?
I'm sorry, I don't know off the top of my head. I haven't added up how much that particular subset of tribes get. I know overall in our appropriations, for instance, 2006, we're anticipating sending out on the order of $760 million through compacts and contracts to all tribes that fit there. But I don't know about this particular subset.
And when these Section 122 tribes are, in fact, funded, do you intend this to be one-time appropriation, recurring appropriation, phased in?
The intent of the program is it's basically recurring appropriations, as we do with a wide variety of other tribes that are subject to Indian self-determination, compacting, and contracting. So each year we're passing out funds through those programs.
All right, sir. Thank you very much. And again, Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member, and colleagues on the committee, it's a challenge, to say the least, put it euphemistically. I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Ms. Christensen?
Mr. Chairman, I would pass on to my colleague on my left, if that's all right with you, and come back later.
Okay, Mr. Inslee.
Thank you. There's such a sour history here, I can understand why settlement discussions may be difficult. And I'm wondering if you can suggest some positive actions to help to increase trust to the extent that's possible on either side. What could the federal government, your department specifically, do in the next 90 days that could help restore trust with the claimants that it has not done, even if not compelled by Congress or a court, but that you could take on your own merits? That's my first question. And second, what do you think the claimants could do in that same direction that have not been compelled by law or statute?
A good question. And I guess one thing I'd like to challenge just a little bit is the opening premise about the animosity stuff. Certainly, this is a very difficult issue, and it's very complicated and has been complicated with 9 years' worth of history in litigation and 100 years' worth of history of the federal government implementing our trust. There is certainly lots and lots of rhetoric and lots of real experiences associated with how the trust has been implemented over time. What I think we in the department have attempted to do is to not personalize the issues that are involved and to actually be open and candid and forthright in what we're trying to do and what we think is reasonable under the circumstances. And I would suggest we would continue to do that. But I would also suggest that there is a very wide gap in perception about what is reasonable in this field. And, for example, based on the facts that we have collected so far...
Can I interrupt you just for a second? I usually don't like to interrupt, but...
No, go ahead.
I really am looking for a positive statement here. And when you say there's not, maybe there's not much emotion on this or anger, I want to tell you there's a lot of anger about this, because I'm very angry about this. I'm very angry at the federal government treated these people like Enron treated its shareholders for years and decades. And a continued pattern with the people that underwent a lot of this for centuries. And I want to tell you, I'm very angry about this. So I don't want you to explain to me why people aren't angry about this. I'd like you to explain to me what you can do to try to get this off dead center, to do more than you have done to date, if there's anything that could possibly get this thing moving forward, and the same thing with the claimants. Mm. And if there's nothing, just tell us, and we'll just take it from there.
Okay, well, I think the reason that we're here is to try to find some amicable solution to this, and that we in the Department of Interior have been active participants, at least in this administration while I've been involved in the process, active participants in a variety of efforts to try to find solutions to this. Those have not been successful so far, not because of personal rancor, but because of the differences of opinion about what is fair and reasonable. We have gone through a very exhaustive process during the last 4 years to do historical accounting, to actually build the fact set so that we could properly inform Congress and properly inform the Department of Justice, who is managing this litigation, as to what the facts are. So what I was suggesting to the panel is that we try to divorce personal feelings about it, and I'm sorry you're angry about the process. There's lots of people in the process who are angry for a variety of reasons on both sides of the fence, but the anger doesn't solve any problem, and that what we're trying to do is be reasonably dispassionate about what are the facts, what is reasonable under the circumstances, and what can we find common ground on. And that's what we've been doing. That's what we would continue to do. That's what our plan would be, to work with the committee to try to find that common ground. I would suggest the plaintiffs have the same sort of obligation if we're going to bring it to settlement, because I think there is a reasonable point in the middle somewhere, and what we need to do is define what that reasonable point is in a way that both Congress is willing to settle there and that the plaintiffs and the administration are willing to settle there. And that's a big undefined area that has risk and uncertainty for all parties. And we're at the table trying to do that, and we appreciate the fact that the committee's at the table trying to do that.
I listened very carefully to what you said, and I failed to hear a single thing suggested that you could do to go in the directions that I requested. And did I miss something, or
what direction are you requesting?
Well, and I'm sorry to go over my time, Mr. Chairman. If you give me another minute, that's permissible. Thank you. What I'm asking you about is there anything you think that your department could do that you have not done to date to increase the level of trust that exists and the hopes that we can continue this ball rolling? And the same to ask what the claimants could do in that direction. What could you do? What additional thing could you do to increase the trust level of the people on the other side of this dispute?
Do you want to comment on that?
If I might, I think, as Mr. Kaysen has stated before, there's been a lot of disagreement in the past about the level of responsibility in this trust and how it's been administered. One of the things that I believe that has been lacking in that sense is what I call, and we have coined, as a beneficiary focus. For many, many years, this trust was treated as a program. In the early years, it was treated as the agency, BIA, being the banker on the reservation for individual Indian people, collecting the money, giving the money for their house, for their horse, for their whatever it might be, and the ledger is replete with that kind of information. In more modern times, because of the fractionation issue, it's been extremely difficult to have personal contact with the beneficiaries. It's not unusual to have 200, 300, or 1,000 owners of an 80-acre, 160-acre parcel of land. So that distance between the manager of the trust and the beneficiary, I think, has caused a lot of the animosity that we see today outside from the accounting issue. And what we have tried to do, and certainly in the last 3 years, is through a comprehensive study of how this trust is administered, how it should be, how we think it should be administered, with the help of the beneficiaries, with the help of lay people and lots of resources in the field, to reform the trust and to do it with a sense of a beneficiary focus. Setting up, for instance, trust administrators and trust officers. One of the things the court mentioned in the beginning is that there was no one at the Department of the Interior that had a fiduciary trust background. It's not something you would normally find in a federal agency unless they were dealing with banking matters or trust matters as such. And what we have done is make it a conscious effort to bring people into this program with a trust background. We made a conscious effort then to reach out to beneficiaries by setting up a call center where, not unlike other trust companies, an individual can call, identify themselves, and get information almost immediately on whatever matter it is they want to know about. What's in my account? When was the lease issued? When's the lease expire? When do you expect the oil and gas payments to be made? What about my probate? What's the status? And we're trying to set up a mechanism where instead of someone walking into an agency and trying to buttonhole someone to get information and then being routed to a dozen different people, they have a phone number they can call. They have a trust officer whose sole responsibility at that agency is to the beneficiary. That's all they have to do is work with the beneficiaries. Trying to find, for instance, whereabouts unknown, as we call them. We have 46,000 people with about $60 million in their account, and we can't locate them. We are making a conscious effort, an extremely strong effort with tribes, with relatives, with newspapers, with the Internet, in any way we can to locate those people to get that money out there. We have made many adjustments in the way that the trust is operated itself in bringing new software in, coordinating systems, bringing the title systems current, working on getting probates brought up to date, bringing a state-of-the-art accounting system so that when a person receives their quarterly statement, they know what they own, they know what came in on their income, and they know what went out on their income. So those are the kinds of things that we're trying to do now with the beneficiaries to make a difference. And that's all in addition, really, to the lawsuit issue over the accounting. And the accounting is to go back and, of course, provide them with a history of what they have received in the past. But going forward, it's the beneficiary focus, I think, that's going to make a difference in how the relationship works between the individual Indian beneficiary in the field and the Department of the Interior.
Thanks for your courtesy, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Drake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Certainly as a new member of Congress, I haven't heard this very extended debate on this issue. And as a representative from Virginia, where we don't have federally recognized tribes or Indian lands, this is my first question sitting here that I really don't want you to answer is, how in the world did we ever get here? And I thought it was interesting, Mr. Kaysen, when you talked about defining the inherent obligation, since there was no instruction from Congress. I would think that you have an absolute obligation to account for someone else's money, whether it's something that's very informal, like helping a relative, or something that's very formal of the federal government managing people's money. So all that said, I have two questions. And the first is, are we continuing to have problems from 1994 on, or is everything that we're talking about now 1994 and before? And the second question is, you know, you've explained that you have found very little error in what you've looked at so far, yet this has been in court for 9 years. You mentioned $176 billion in a claim and a proposed settlement of $27.5 billion. Have you or someone in the department, have you reviewed why do they think this amount of money is owed? And why do you think it isn't? And is there, what's going on in between that the department would think this is probably not a lot of error, yet there are people who receive the money who think there is obviously a very glaring error? So those are my two questions.
Good questions. And it's probably fortunate you said don't explain the history because it's long and complicated. Regarding the $176 billion and why the plaintiffs think that's owed, they're going to be up next, so I would suggest that you just ask them to explain.
I think that's where Mr. Inslee's coming from. I mean, obviously, if someone thinks you owe them $176 billion, I would have hoped you would have gone to look and say, is there any reason for this? If someone told me I owed them a month's rent that I hadn't paid them, I'd go see if I made that payment and did they not get my check.
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, if you aren't willing to look at that question...
Well, that's exactly what we've been looking at.
Well, you have looked at it. I mean, I will get them to explain why they think they owe so much. Good. But I guess my question is, I would think in the department, if I were in that department and someone thought I owed that amount of money and I didn't think I owed it, I'd at least have an explanation why I thought there was a discrepancy between the two numbers.
Yeah. That's fine, and that's exactly what the historical accounting process is all about. There's an assertion that the funds that have come into the department have not been accurately managed. There is an assertion that the opening balances of all the accounts that we currently have on the books does not reflect an accurate opening balance. The historical accounting process is basically designed to go back and take a look at the transactions that have occurred in those accounts to see if that opening balance carried on from 94 represents an accurate opening balance. So what we have is an assertion that there isn't accuracy, that the funds have been mistreated over time. What we're doing in the historical accounting process is basically going account by account and looking backwards and saying, well, tell me about the transactions that have occurred in this account. It's a fairly complicated process in that when you take an account by account, you find an opening balance, you find all the transactions that occurred in that account, both incoming checks and outgoing checks, and you go to an ending balance, just like your bank statement. So that's basically what we're going through. Our assessment of the $176 billion issue is it's entirely specious that the assumption as we understand it is that the assertion is that $13 billion came in, never a penny was paid out, and then you put compound interest on it for 100 years, and that's how you get to $176 billion. I think that completely is inconsistent with the facts. But the assertion's there. And it's my understanding of the $27.5 billion is instead of assuming that 100% of the money didn't go out, you just assume that 20% of the money didn't go out. And then you add compound interest on that, and that's how you get to $27.5 billion. What we're trying to do is get beyond the rhetoric and get to actual accounting facts on a account-by-account basis. What are the facts about this account? Are there errors in this account? Does the ending balance represent what should be in the account? And that in large part, what we've found is the answer is yes, so far. We have not done all the accounting. It is possible that as we go further and further back in time, we will find some issue of fraud or find some issue where the accounting system wasn't working properly. But so far, after $100 million worth of accounting, we haven't found that. We found a few random errors.
How about the 1994 question? That should be easier. I mean, are there still problems alleged 94 on, or is this all before 94, other than the account balance in 94?
Yeah, the way I would answer that is since 94, we use that as how we define the class of who we would do the accounting for. And we basically, in our plan, said we would account for anybody that had an open account from 94 forward. In terms of the accounting process, we were using electronic means to account 94 and after, and that we actually converted about 99 into a new system called SEI, and they do a lot of the trust accounting in the country, and we use their system 99 forward. So it's arguable whether there was any issue between 94 and 99. We haven't found any material issue there, but it's arguable. And then since about year 99-2000, we've been putting out periodic quarterly statements to people, and we balance the accounts down to the penny every day. And so we think that there's no issue there at all.
Mr. Udall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secretary Kaysen, in the course of this case, the judge made a ruling that shut down your computer system and you were unable to pay many people, and many out in my district were hurt by that. Has that been completely resolved now? Is that
No.
system up and running and people getting paid?
Yes, at the moment. The issue is not completely resolved. We just finished a 59-day evidentiary trial in the district court. The district court judge issued a decision on that. We appealed. The decision was basically an order for us to disconnect from the internet and the intranet any computer that housed or provided access to individual and trust data. We asked for a stay from the court and within about 18 hours got an administrative stay from the Court of Appeals. It's being argued right now, or it's being briefed right now in terms of getting a permanent stay, and the appeal documents are being filed now. So the issue is not completely resolved at this point. We are up and running right now. We are able, with the administrative stay, to keep our computer systems up and collect the information necessary to actually make payments to Indians, and we are doing that right now as a routine part of business, but the issue itself has not been resolved.
But as far as you know, the Indians are being paid.
Yes.
On their accounts, and there isn't anybody that's not being paid.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay. Because that was a situation where many people, as you probably know, were living on those checks on a monthly basis, and it was very, very important to them and their families and their livelihood and all of that. So we appreciate you getting up and running. Has the department or you taken a position on terminating the trust?
Are you talking about on individuals or
individuals and
overall?
Yeah.
I think there's a pretty consistent opinion within the Department of Interior that no one is talking about terminating the trust. There's a lot of discussion, Congressman, about the character of the trust, that there are elements of this trust that don't make any sense. And we would sure like to work with Congress and continue to work with Congress to try to amend some of those. And what I mean by that is we have a terrible problem with fractionation. That had individual Indian allotments that passed down over time or passed down in undivided interest. And we have circumstances where we have individual allotments that have more than 1,000 owners on them. And so no one ends up with real beneficial use, and the property gets devalued as a result of having multiple owners. So we'd like to have a better way of consolidating those interests together so that some Indian individual would be able to have beneficial use of their property. Ross has circumstances where he has thousands of accounts that have less than a dollar in them, that we end up having to pay an administrative fee to keep track of in trust an amount that's less than a dollar account for thousands of accounts. That doesn't make any sense. In the banking world, you would close those out through administrative fees. So there are certain elements of the trust that don't make a lot of sense in terms of trying to produce a dollar's worth of benefit for a dollar's worth of invested appropriations. And we'd like to see if there's some way that we can address some of those. But it's not a repudiation of the trust that we're really talking about. It's more of how can we ensure that we spend money wisely to actually produce material benefits where we do it.
Congressman Inslee asked the question about settlement and how you were mm-hmm. moving forward on settlement. Is your sense that in the next 6 months or a year you'll be able to bring to us a proposal with regard to settlement, something that'll give us a something to work on and to bite into on this? I mean, are those kinds of discussions going on?
The discussion certainly has been going on for quite a while. And it's our intent to work with this committee and the Senate counterparts, Senator McCain and Dorgan, to see if there's some way we can actually define a common ground for settlement. We need to develop together some sort of paradigm of how you would actually construct a number and how you would construct a payout from that number to get it down to the individuals that feel like they're aggrieved in the process. We stand ready to do everything that we can to help with that. We've been exploring it for a long time. We've proffered different methodologies that could be used to approach developing a number and a settlement. But so far we haven't found one that's actually gained traction where everybody says, oh yeah, that's the right way. So we plan to work with this committee in looking at all the options that the committee would like to explore. We certainly have ideas on it, and we'd like to share those as well.
Thank you. And if you come up with something, we'd like to work with you on it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Herseth.
Thank you, Chairman Pombo and Ranking Member Rahal, for the opportunity to discuss the Indian Trust Reform Act of 2005. This is obviously an issue of great importance for communities within South Dakota and the entire region. Roughly one-third of the Indian individual Indian money account holders reside throughout the Great Plains region. I want to talk through a little bit with you about grappling with this problem of fractionation.
Mm-hmm.
Chairman Pombo had a hearing, I believe it was either earlier this year or at the end of last year, in which one of my constituents, Charlie Colomb, testified about this problem in particular. And then in July, this committee held a joint hearing with the House Financial Services Committee on improving land grant title procedures for Native Americans, and Mr. Arch Wells, acting director of the Office of Trust Services, testified about DOI's efforts to modernize and improve its trust records. Now, in particular, he referred to an effort to clean up data used to process title status requests in the trust asset and accounting management system. Can you tell me this morning how close this project is to completion, Mr. Kaysen?
Well, we have a plan that we're operating against right now that it is our hope to get all of our title records up to date in the computer system by November 30 of 2007. There's a substantial amount of backlogged information that hasn't been put in the computer systems. And as Arch probably explained to you, we've gone through a process here recently during the last 4 years of moving from the legacy system, the land record information system, to a new system called TAMS. And we have converted all the software. It's available to all of our regions now, so that's been done. The database has been converted over from LRIS to TAMS. That's done. And then what we're doing right now is basically all of the records that had not been entered into either system, that's backlogged right now. We have a plan for bringing all that up to date, and the due date is November of 2007.
And at this stage, do you feel you have adequate funding to fully implement the system?
That's a good question. We're hopeful that the resources we have available and that we would anticipate as part of the 2007 budget would be adequate to get the job done. We're actually partnering with OST and BIA together to utilize funds in both houses to make sure that we get the resources on the ground to do the job, and we're hopeful that those resources will be adequate.
And do you have any concerns that the personnel dedicated to the conversion and implementing the plan fully take away from the office's ability to do the accounting under the process that you've set forth?
Well, it's not... I would say yes and no, and sorry to be ambiguous. We do have an issue. That is, our Land Title Records Office is a nexus point for a number of efforts that we have ongoing. One of those efforts is up getting all the information into our TAM system so that it's current. Part of it is our probate process, where we need to get records from them to conduct probates. And we have four or five different efforts like that that all have a nexus point, the LTROs. It's one of the things that we're watching very closely to make sure that we don't overwhelm the system at that nexus point. And if we're getting to that point, we will be looking fairly routinely at adding more resources or prioritizing the workload so we can get the most important stuff done within that organization.
Okay, well, I appreciate your responses, and sure. It's an issue of particular concern, so we'll be working with you to monitor the progress. If I could just switch gears with another question. I think you replied to a question from Mr. Kildee that under the accounting process that DOI prefers, that would cost roughly the $335 million, you're looking at accounts after 1994, and so you'd be analyzing approximately 275 to 300,000 accounts.
Mm-hmm.
How many individual Indian money accounts does the department manage overall?
That would include all of them that we manage right now. So the 300,000, if you pick 300,000, it includes all the ones that we do right now. Those would be part of the process. And then the differentiation is we're considering the historical accounting period to be those accounts that were open on year 2000, plus all the ones that had been opened as of 94 and closed prior to 2000. Those are in the historical accounting period. And then we have a current accounting process that does all the ones that were open after 2000. And all of those individuals get a quarterly statement routinely.
May I follow up with one more question, Mr. Chairman? I'll seek a little bit further clarification mm-hmm. from you on that. But as you describe the differences between the accounting process that Judge Lamberth mm-hmm. set forth, that I understand, you know, on appeal, questions have been raised, but then as you describe the differences from that process versus DOI's process at the $335 million, mm-hmm. talking about the differences, did DOI ever consider a more expensive accounting procedure? In other words, when you decided upon the one that you would prefer, did DOI examine, say, three or five alternatives and estimate what they would cost, and where did the $335 million accounting process mm-hmm. fall in that category? I'm just wondering the breadth of DOI's mm-hmm. Evaluation dealing with various factors that would be fair to the plaintiffs as well as the costs to mm-hmm. DOI.
Yes, we did. And if you'd like, I'll get you a copy of the plan that we submitted to the court, because part of what we looked at is what were the relative variables associated with an accounting. And it had variables about for whom do you do an accounting, over what time period do you do an accounting, how much information you would need to constitute an accounting, do you look at land as well as cash or cash only. So there were a number of variables that we looked at, and the considerations that we built into that process were things like how much will it cost, how long will it take to reach a conclusion, what's the relative level of accuracy that would be the output of this product or process. So we looked at those variables in line with the variables of what it would constitute in accounting and drew a conclusion about what we thought was the most productive way to go about this between cost and time and accuracy. And that's where we ended up with the plan that we had. Clearly, it's subject to debate. Other people who look at that have other opinions about how it ought to be done. But that's what we're trying to get to, is a point of reasonable accuracy with reasonable time and reasonable cost to provide an assurance that the accounting system either was working reasonably well or there were systemic flaws and we needed to do a much broader, grander effort. So that's how we got to where we were.
And the process is the least expensive? Is the one that you...
No, I wouldn't say it's the least expensive. Certainly you could define an accounting that would cost less than $335 million. But it was one that we thought was a reasonable plan under the circumstances. And part of it is right now the balance for individual accounts as of that 2000 time period was $400 million. So what we were proffering as a plan that cost $335 million to assure that the opening balance of $400 million was reasonably representative of what should have been there. So at some point when we're introducing the cost element into it, you go, there's a balance of $400 million. How much do you want to spend on ensuring that $400 million is an accurate representation of what should have been there?
I appreciate it. Mr. Chairman, thank you for extending additional time. I will look forward to seeing the document you submitted sure. to the court, as well as what Mr. Rahal had requested in terms of putting together an assessment of different error rates and different programs and processes. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank the witness for the testimony. Members of the committee may have additional questions. Those will be submitted to you in writing. If you can answer those in writing so that they can be included as part of the hearing record. I know several members have asked you for additional information. I'm sure other members that will have additional questions as well.
That's fine, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you very much.